What does that mean? It could mean many things. He could have argued with someone along the path. It could have been an attempted mugging, although your father was found with his wallet on him. It's possible that some kid threw a rock that hit your father and it was a complete accident. We just don't know. That's why I'm here, just to ask you some questions.
Okay, Harry said, then added,
Should I text my stepmother? Should she be here? I'd like to hear from you right now.
Sure, Harry said. He watched as the detective pulled a spiral-bound notebook and a pen from the inside of his jacket. Harry thought that he couldn't have been more than 40 years old, although he had a receding hairline, noticeable even though his hair was cut very close to his scalp. He had a long nose and thin lips, and his dark eyes were set deep in their sockets.
Can I ask you some questions about your father?
He said. Harry nodded.
Had anything changed in his life recently? How was his marriage? Honestly, I don't know that much about my father's marriage. How long had they since I went to college? So, about 4 years. Can you think of anyone who might have had a reason to harm your father? No. Disgruntled customers from the store, old girlfriends.
Harry shook his head.
Do you know anything about your father's financial situation? You mean, did he have money? That, or did he have money problems? How was the store doing? Fine, I think. My father did okay in his business, well enough to send me to college. He had some family money as well, I think. And my mom had some money from her parents, my biological mother. Your mother is... she died, about 7 years ago.
The detective jotted that fact down in his notebook, as though it was the first thing he learned that he hadn't known already.
How did she die?
He asked.
Of lung cancer. Did your father have close friends here in Kennewick that you knew of?
He was friends with John Richards, who works for him.
What do you know about him? Not much. He's a retiree who started out by volunteering to help out at the store, but now he pretty much co-manages it with my father.
Harry stumbled over the words, aware he was using the present tense.
And they were friends?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if they were social with each other, if they did things outside of the store, but my father relied on him.
What about other employees?
I know that he sometimes got someone to help out during the summer when there was the most foot traffic in the store, but they were usually teenagers or college students.
You never came up and helped out during the summer?
No, Harry said.
Okay. What about other friends? Did your father and his wife socialize with other couples at all?
I don't really know, but I don't think so. Alice has a friend named Chrissy Herrick. That's where she is right now. And she's married, but I don't know if they did couple things together.
The detective pulled a vibrating phone from his pants pocket. He checked the screen, then put the phone into his suit jacket pocket.
Sorry,
he said, then slid forward fractionally on the sofa.
Anyone else you can think of that your father had regular contact with? Anyone he kept in touch with in New York?
His old business partner, Ron Krakowski, was there, and they were still close, but he never even leaves the city.
He jotted the name down on his pad, then put it back in his suit jacket. It was clear that he was getting ready to go.
You've been very helpful, Harry,
he said as he stood. Harry stood as well, and accepted the card that the detective was holding out to him.
If you think of anything else, even if it seems insignificant, give me a call. That's my cell number on the card,
the detective added. At the door, Detective Dixon asked Harry if he was planning on staying in Kennewick a while.
I have no other plans, Harry said. I'll probably help out at the store.
As soon as the detective turned to go, Harry watched as he pulled his cell phone out, thumbed the screen, then lifted it to his ear. He was talking as he got into the maroon Impala and shut the door behind him. The car's glass was tinted. Harry turned back into the house and thought of calling Alice, but quickly decided against it. Instead, he wandered back into the living room and looked out at the rainy day, trying to wrap his head around the new information. He felt as though his body was reacting to the news faster than his mind was. His chest hurt, and his limbs felt electrified, like he needed to do something physical. He realized the feeling was anger. His father might have been killed. Harry's mind flashed on the young brunette woman that he'd seen outside of the house and at the funeral. He remembered that he was going to ask Alice about her today. He stared at the window. It was still raining, but a streak of blue sky had appeared over the tree line to the west. Harry suddenly needed to get out of the house. He grabbed one of his father's raincoats from the row of pegs in the front hall and stepped through the door onto the front steps. He felt instantly better, breathing in the damp air. He walked to the end of the driveway, then arbitrarily turned right and began to walk, head down, the diminishing rain pattering on the hood of his father's coat. Chapter 9. Then. Edith Moss's funeral was held at a church in Biddeford, and she was buried in a family plot. Alice wondered if that was what she would have wanted, considering the way she talked about her family, but Alice also knew it didn't matter. Her mother was dead and would never know the difference. Edith's two brothers were there, and some of their kids from assorted girlfriends and ex-wives. Alice hadn't seen any of them since they'd moved out of Biddeford to Kennewick.
"Good riddance to bad rubbish," Edith had said.
Alice actually liked her Uncle Claude, even though he was supposedly the worst of the two Moss brothers. He rarely worked and drank all day. But he was always in a good mood, and when Alice was a little kid, he'd give her packs of fruit-flavored chewing gum. Her Uncle Theo, who never gave her anything, was a construction foreman with a bad back who was now on disability. In the receiving line, he said to Alice,
"Guess you get all that Saltonstall money now, eh?"
"I guess," Alice said, resolving to never see any of her Biddeford relatives again. A few of Jake's friends from the bank came, but no family. Gina came, of course, and so did Justin and a few other kids from high school that Alice barely knew. Justin couldn't take his eyes off Alice during the brief, terrible reception in the church's basement. She wondered if he was trying to figure out if her boyfriend was there. Would he know she'd been lying? She didn't particularly care one way or another. She hadn't thought she'd ever see him again after the party at his house, and she was pretty sure that now she'd never see him again after her mother's funeral. Everyone kept asking Alice what her plans were. Was she going away to college? Would she come back to Biddeford? She told them she didn't know yet, but she did know. She wanted to keep living with Jake. She'd take classes at MCC, just for something to do. But now she had Jake all to herself. She pictured them trying new restaurants up and down the coast, maybe even traveling together. After the reception, Jake drove Alice back along Route 1 from Biddeford and through Kennebunkport.
"I don't want to go home quite yet," he said.
"I don't either." They went to the Brasserie for an early supper. Alice was wearing a Laura Ashley dress and more makeup than she usually wore. Jake ordered a dinner for both of them and a bottle of wine. The waitress brought the bottle and two glasses and never asked Alice for ID. Alice hadn't touched any of the deviled ham sandwiches or potato salad they'd served at the church, and she was starving. She ate all the bread herself, soaking it in the garlic butter from the escargot. She tried her steak rare, the way Jake ordered his, instead of medium, the way she usually got it. And it tasted better, much better, especially if you didn't think about the pool of bright red juice on the plate. They hadn't talked about Edith's death since the night it had happened. As soon as Alice, having watched her mother choke to death, had turned to find Jake watching her, she'd immediately said, "We need to call an ambulance." And Jake had gone to the wall phone and dialed 911. After hanging up, he rushed to Edith's side and pressed two fingers against the side of her neck. "She was like this She was like this when I got home, Alice said, her whole body beginning to tremble.
When did you get here?
Jake asked. Just now, just a minute ago. How long have you been down here? Jake took Alice by her shoulders and moved her backward away from her mother's body.
I thought I heard something and came down the stairs. I'm so sorry, Alice. Your mother was drinking and I shouldn't have left her down here.
No, no, I shouldn't have even left the house tonight.
Shh, Jake said,
pulling Alice into his arms and holding her while her trembling turned into uncontrollable shaking. When the EMTs arrived, one of them asked Alice if this was how she'd found her mother. She wasn't moving, Alice said. She was just lying there. After dessert, Jake said,
Let's stay here tonight. I can't face going back home. I'll get us two rooms.
Okay, Alice said. He left Alice alone at the table while he went to the front desk to book the rooms. She wanted to tell him that he could just get one room, but her voice had stopped working. He came back with two keys. The front desk had also sold him two toothbrushes and a tube of toothpaste. Both of the rooms were nice, but one of them, the one that Jake insisted that Alice take, faced the ocean and had an outside deck. Jake had bought a second bottle of wine from the restaurant to take upstairs, and together they sat on the deck, the night getting cooler, and drank it. Alice took small sips, not wanting to get drunk, not wanting to be like Edith had been. But the wine tasted good, and was making all her muscles tingle and relax.
You were brave today, Jake said.
Was I? I didn't do anything.
No, but you were there. You came. How are you feeling?
She thought for a moment about what to say, then decided not to lie. I feel nothing. I feel cold.
Cold isn't nothing.
No, I feel cold right now. It's cold out here. She laughed, and so did Jake. Inside the room, he pulled her into his arms and hugged her. His skin smelled of cologne, and he was tall enough that his chin rested above her head. She tilted her head and kissed his neck, and he brought his hand up to her chin, tilting it so that he could kiss her. He brought her to the bed, his hands sliding up her thighs to the elastic top of her stockings. She lifted her hips as he pulled them off. Afterward, in the black darkness of the room, he said,
No one, absolutely no one, can know about this.
I won't tell anyone, Alice said. I don't even want to know anyone else. I just want to know you.
I feel the same way, he said.
Alice woke at dawn to the sound of gulls. She was shivering. They'd left the door to the balcony cracked. She got up to close it, just as the door to the hallway opened up and Jake was coming back into the room. She startled, not aware that he had left. Where'd you go? She asked.
The other room. I made it look like someone had slept there. Just in case. I didn't want it to look...
No. I understand. He was staring at her, and Alice realized she was naked. She stood, letting him look, and then he came to her. They returned to the condo that afternoon. They walked the exterior stairs up to the front door. Alice used her key, but before she could step inside, Jake said,
Wait.
Then he lifted her into his arms and carried her. Like a bride, over the threshold. Chapter 10 Now Harry got back to Gray Lady at just past 3. He had walked for miles, eventually winding up at York Hill State Park, where he'd climbed a muddy trail to reach the top of York Hill, less than 700 feet of elevation, but enough to see the White Mountains to the west and the Atlantic to the east. The rain had stopped completely by the time he got to the summit. The sky was half clear, half darkened by clouds. He was alone, his shoes soaked through, and he felt like screaming at the top of his lungs. But he couldn't bring himself to do it. A voice at the back of his head was laughing at how cliched it would be. Instead, he sat on a boulder, wondering what would happen if he simply lay back and didn't move. Would he freeze to death in the middle of the night? He tried it, his shoulder landing in a shallow puddle of rainwater, then immediately sat up again. He couldn't even fall apart properly, and he decided that he would go back to the house to hear what Alice had to say about the latest developments. He was surprised to find her in the kitchen, ingredients spread out on the butcher block island. "Oh, good," she said when she saw Harry. "I'm starting to prepare dinner. You'll be eating here, I hope?"
"Sure," Harry said, then added, "Did you talk to a detective today?"
"I did. Did you?"
"They think it might not be an accident."
"Well, that's what they say. I don't know what to think, except that either way, he's still gone, Harry."
"I know, but if someone had something to do with it..."
"Maybe someone was just trying to mug him, and your father fought back. Maybe it was still an accident."
"If someone was trying to mug him, then it wasn't an accident."
"No, I know," Alice said, beginning to slice an onion. "The police will figure it out."
"Where did they talk with you?" Harry asked.
"Who? The police? They found me at Chrissy's house. I think you must have told them I was there. Chrissy wasn't surprised either. We both thought that someone else might have been responsible."
"But who?"
Harry asked, trying to keep his rising irritation at Alice's lackadaisical attitude from showing.
"Did they ask you if you had any idea who might have been involved?"
She stopped slicing and looked directly at Harry. "They did ask me. I told them I had no idea." Her eyes held his, almost challenging him to call her a liar. He felt she was holding something back, but he didn't say anything. "It doesn't matter, though, Harry, does it?"
"What do you mean?"
"Your father's dead. He's not coming back."
"I know that, but that doesn't mean I don't want to know what happened to him."
He had spoken too loudly, and Alice put her head down, staring at the perfect slivers of onion on the cutting board. When she looked up again, Harry could see bright spots of red on her cheeks. "You're right. I'm sorry. It was a lot to take in this morning, and right now I just want to make dinner and not think about it. It's enough that he's not here, and now to know that... She turned away, her shoulders beginning to shake, and Harry went and gave her a hug. She sobbed into his shoulder while he stroked her back.
"I'm sorry," Harry said. "Dinner tonight sounds great. What time?"
She pulled away from him, and with a look of almost childish joy on her face, she said, 7 o'clock? Maybe a drink at 6:30? Have you had lunch? I can make you a snack." Harry accepted an apple, which Alice cut into slices and put on a plate for him. Then he went up to his room. He didn't come back down until 6:30. He unpacked some more things, looked through his father's books, picking out an Ed McBain novel he hadn't read before, one of the 87th Precinct books called Sadie When She Died. He didn't think he'd be able to read, but he tried anyway. He kept thinking about how it had felt to hold Alice in his arms while she cried, the way her body had shaken, and the feel of her skin against his. He tried to stop himself from imagining the hug suddenly becoming sexual, one of her hands sliding down into his jeans, her telling him that it would be the only thing that would help her grief. He started the book, reading a page without understanding any of the words, then started again, and managed to get into it. He'd read half before he realized it was nearly 6. He showered and went downstairs. There was music playing, a David Bowie album, the one with China Girl on it, and something was cooking in the oven. Alice had changed her clothes. She wore a long dress in a fabric that looked hand-dyed. It was scoop-necked and cinched at the waist.
"What can I do to help?"
Harry asked her. She'd been assembling a salad, and she jumped a little when he spoke. "Nothing, nothing," she said. "No, actually, you can make us each a drink. Do you mind? A martini for me." Harry went to the side table in the dining room, where the booze was kept. It was obvious that Alice wanted some semblance of a normal evening, despite the fact that her husband was dead. Harry decided that it might be a good thing. He'd read a book this afternoon, so maybe life just needed to go on. And if Alice relaxed enough, then maybe she'd open up to him. He still thought she was holding something back. He found a large bottle of Plymouth gin, his father's favorite, and Harry, who'd watched his father drink his single, large martini every night at 6 on the dot, knew how he liked it. Shaken very cold, no vermouth, and served in a tumbler with 3 cocktail onions.
"How do you like your martini, Alice? Same as my father?"
"Yes, but with olives, and about half the size of the drinks your father used to make, please." Harry made the drink, got a beer for himself, then asked again if she needed any help and was told to take a seat on one of the stools around the island. There were snacks out, baby carrots with hummus and crackers with port wine cheese. "Your friend Paul is so nice," Alice said, turning away from her salad and sipping at her drink.
"It was great he came. He skipped graduation, you know?"
"No, I know. It's great to have a friend like that. They're easier to make when you're young, you know, than in real life. Let me tell you." The timer made a tinny buzz, and Alice pulled a large baking dish from the oven. "It's chicken cordon bleu casserole," she said. "Have you had it before?"
"No, but it sounds delicious. My appetite, though..."
"Oh, I know. I haven't been able to eat a thing." She pinched the bridge of her nose. "Anyway, I just wanted to cook, just to have some semblance of normality. Keep myself busy." Alice turned back to the casserole, poking at it with a fork, while Harry finished his beer. There was a silence, and Harry tried to think of something to say that didn't revolve around his father's death. He remembered the stranger at his father's funeral, and said,
"I saw this girl at the memorial service yesterday. She had dark hair down to her shoulders and was wearing a gray dress. She didn't come through the receiving line."
Alice frowned. "Was it Ginny Wells?"
"No, I know Ginny. This girl was there alone, toward the back of the church, and she had a red purse with her. I just didn't know who she was, and it's strange because I thought I actually saw her Friday when I arrived here, out on the street."
"Out on our street?"
"Yeah, I think I saw her from my window upstairs."
"That's odd."
"That was why I was asking. I'm sure it's just one of Dad's customers."
"Most of his customers were old men, like he was, but I don't know. I don't remember seeing her. Should we eat in the dining room?" Alice let Harry bring the hot casserole and the salad to the long dining room table, constructed from renovated barn wood. There was a trivet waiting on the table, and he put down the casserole, large enough to feed an army. Places had been laid with wine glasses and 2 forks, one for the salad, Harry supposed.
"White wine okay?"
Alice said, entering with an unopened bottle.
"Oh, sure."
"Can you open it up and pour us some, Harry? And then we'll finally eat." Despite having lost his appetite again after that morning's visit from the detective, the food tasted good. It was clear that Alice was not in the mood to talk about serious matters. She asked Harry rapid-fire questions about his future plans, all of which he deflected. She picked at her food and took small sips of wine, her pale cheeks becoming flushed.
"And what about a girlfriend?" she asked, after bringing him a butterscotch sundae from the kitchen. "Anyone special you left behind?"
The words sounded rehearsed.
"No, not really."
"Boyfriend, then?"
Harry thought she was trying to sound casual, but she punctuated the question with an odd laugh,
and her flushed cheeks had become almost mottled with red.
No, I don't have one of those either.
I hope I didn't. I just wondered because I thought maybe Paul...
Yes, Paul is gay.
I'm crying.
No, it's fine.
They were silent for a moment. Harry asked,
Did my father wonder?
Wonder what?
Did he wonder if I was gay? Is that why you were asking?
If he did wonder, he never brought it up with me. And honestly, you knew him, more interested in what was happening in one of his books than what was happening around him. And he wouldn't have cared. You know that, too. Harry finished his dessert. Alice was drinking the dregs of the wine and rubbing her finger absent-mindedly on the wooden table, her eyes slightly glazed over. In the light from the flickering candle, she looked not a whole lot older than Harry. Her skin, except for around her eyes, was entirely unlined. She tapped her finger on the table and shifted her gaze, catching Harry watching her.
"You look tired," he said. "Let me clean up, since you cooked the dinner."
She sat up straight. "No, I'll clean. I want to. You can help me bring the dishes into the kitchen, but that's it. I insist." Harry did as he was told, leaving Alice cleaning dishes in the large double sink. He said goodnight and was turning to go when she reached out a hand. He took it and felt a slight tug, and she leaned over and kissed Harry on the cheek. Her skin was slightly damp from the steam of the hot water. "Thank God for you, Harry. I don't know what..." She didn't finish the sentence.
"Thanks again for dinner, Alice."
"And Harry, one more thing. I talked with John today, and he really needs you to help him out in the store tomorrow. Could you... do you mind?" Harry said he didn't mind. Back in his room, he cracked a window and tried to get back into the Ed McBain book, but he kept thinking about Alice, her damp cheek on his as she kissed him goodnight. He also kept thinking about her refusal to discuss what had happened with her husband. Was it because she knew more than she was saying? Or was she simply someone who didn't want to think about anything unpleasant? He realized how little he knew about her. Was it because he'd never asked? Or was it because his father had never offered? And now here he was, living for a summer with this strange woman, and she was practically all the family he had left. He fell asleep above the covers and woke up cold. He got up and shut the window, then got under the comforter. He listened to the house, so much quieter than his dormitory, where he could lie in bed and listen to the muffled sounds of its other inhabitants. Here, all he could hear was the occasional sound that old houses made, the almost unnoticeable ticks and sighs. He didn't really like it, the enormity of the quiet, the way it made him feel more alone than he usually did. He felt the negative thoughts rolling toward him, and knew if he let them in, he wouldn't be able to sleep for hours. He recited the Lord's Prayer to himself, even though the words had long been meaningless to him, but it was too late. The horrible dread, this now familiar feeling of insignificance, coursed through him. As always, it felt more like fear than sadness. He knew it would pass, and he concentrated on relaxing his body and focusing on his sensations, listening to the house. After a while, he was beginning to fall asleep again when he heard the creak of the stairs, maybe Alice coming up to bed. Then he heard faint sounds just outside his door. He listened intently, sometimes hearing them and sometimes not. Moving slowly and quietly, he got out of the bed and took 3 steps along the worn rug to stand in front of the door. He turned his ear toward the door and listened. It was unmistakable. He could hear Alice breathing just on the other side of the door. He shifted his weight, and a floor plank made a squeaking sound. He listened to Alice's footsteps as she retreated quickly down the hall. Chapter 11. then. After Edith's death, Jake and Alice settled, quickly and naturally, into a new life together. Alice, as planned, enrolled in classes at the community college, commuting back and forth. She kept her own bedroom at the beachside condominium, but spent every night in the master bedroom with Jake, even though there were so many reminders of her mother around.
"Should we pack some of these things away?"
Jake asked one morning. He was holding up a half-empty perfume bottle while Alice toweled herself dry in the ensuite bathroom. "I don't mind," she said. "I mean, do what you want. You can throw that perfume away. I'll never use it." Jake shrugged and put the perfume back on the shelf where he'd found it. He watched Alice dry herself. "What are you looking at?" she said, smiling. She was bent over, drying her calves.
"You don't know what you have there, do you?"
"What I have?"
"What you are. What you look like. Right now, you are absolute perfection in every way. You know that? Youth and beauty."
"And I'm wasting it on you." She straightened up and smiled so that he knew she was kidding. Even so, she caught a brief look of concern cross his face, like a wisp of a cloud crossing the sun.
"I would never keep you here," he said.
"I will never leave." He pulled her from the bathroom to the bed. As always, what they did together started out slow and reverent, Jake treating her with something akin to worship, and it always ended in an animalistic frenzy, Jake taking complete control. Later, Alice would find bruises on her skin that she didn't remember getting. She was as happy as she had ever been. It was a month after the funeral. When Alice was alone in the house, which was fairly often, she occasionally looked through her mother's things, sorting through her clothes and shoes, her books, and her few mementos. Some of it Alice wanted to keep, a decent cocktail dress, for example, and the Gucci bag that Edith had bought from the fancy secondhand store in Portland. But most of it was junk, and Alice would fill grocery bags with clothes, bringing them down to the condo dumpster out back and throwing them away, a little at a time. For some reason, she didn't want to do this in front of Jake, even though she thought it would please him. Still, he must have noticed that there were less and less of Edith's things around, and that more and more of Alice's things were making their way into the master bedroom. At the bottom of the bedroom closet was an old liquor store box filled with some of the more personal effects that Edith had kept, including her Biddeford High School yearbook. Alice had seen pictures of Edith when she'd been young, but never pictures of her as a teenager. There she was, in black and white, her hair in a bouffant, looking prettier than any other girl in her graduating class. Alice also found a picture of her in the cheerleaders squad, and one candid of her at a car wash fundraiser. She wore tight white shorts and a cute sleeveless top, and she was smiling, not at the camera, but at another girl. Both had soap bubbles in their hair, and Edith was holding a hose. Alice couldn't stop looking at the picture, partly because her mother looked so beautiful and so happy, but mostly because of how much she looked like Alice did now. How had she gone from that to what she became? That sloppy, drunken wreck, drooling on a couch. Alice looked through the rest of the box. There was a cheap stuffed monkey that looked like it had been won in a fair, a second-place ribbon beginning to fray, a Bible with a white cover and Edith's name inside of it, and two letters, typewritten on thin, oniony paper, that Alice was shocked to discover were from Gary Shurtleff, Alice's biological father. Both were postmarked from San Diego, California. Both were short and apologetic, although in the second one he called Edith an uppity bitch for not writing him back. Neither of the letters mentioned a baby, even though Alice assumed he'd written them after he'd gotten her mother pregnant. Edith had once told Alice that her father had scampered out west as soon as he found out he was going to be a father. Now, Alice wondered if her father had ever known about her. She also wondered where he was now. In California, still? Then she put the letters back into the box with the yearbook and the Bible and the few other sentimental items that Edith had kept, and brought the whole box down to the dumpster and got rid of it. The first winter after high school, the first winter that Alice was alone with Jake, was long and particularly cold. From January through most of March, the coast was pounded with an almost weekly storm, the temperatures rarely above freezing. Alice didn't mind. When she wasn't at college, where she'd enrolled in the business administration program with an accounting concentration, she was happy to be at home, warm in the condominium, with its views of the gray ocean, mirrored by its gray sky. The weather made her lazy and hungry. Every day she'd eat macaroni and cheese for lunch, then drowse on the couch, a textbook open across her lap, soap operas playing on the television in the background. She didn't really pay much attention to them, except for General Hospital, but she liked the background noise. Jake always called before he left the bank, and it would give her time to take a shower, put something nice on, apply a little makeup. On the first real warm day of spring, sometime in mid-May, she met Jake at the door wearing her favorite pair of shorts and a bikini top. "Summer's here," she said. He squeezed her skin just above the waistline of the shorts and said,
"I'm surprised you can still fit into those things."
That night, after Jake had fallen asleep, Alice slid from the bed naked and went to the bathroom and weighed herself. She had gained weight, 10 pounds at least. Of course, since high school had ended, she no longer ran. She never really exercised at all, so it was no wonder she was getting fat. The following day, after Jake had left for the bank, she put on a one-piece bathing suit and walked down to the water's edge. There were a few shell collectors out, but they were dressed in jeans and sweatshirts. It was going to be a warm day, but it wasn't warm yet, and the water numbed her ankle bones. Still, she remembered what Jake had said, and she slid into the icy water, swimming hard for 20 minutes till her lungs burned and her arms were heavy and useless. Walking back across the firm sand to the condominium, Alice told herself that she would swim as long and as hard as she could every day. Her body would return to normal. She wondered how long it would be before Jake noticed that she was starting to lose weight. She imagined him looking at her one evening as she changed out of her clothes and into the lingerie she slept in, imagining him reaching out a hand to touch her flat stomach and telling her how amazing she looked. It didn't happen exactly like that, but after swimming every day for a month, there was a night in June when Jake asked Alice to slowly strip for him in the living room while he sat on the couch and watched. It wasn't the first time he'd asked Alice to do this, but it was rare, and usually after they'd come back from a nice dinner out. That night in June, they'd driven all the way into Portland to go to a new French restaurant that had recently opened. The food was good, but when Jake had ordered a bottle of wine for the table, the waitress had asked for Alice's ID.
"Oh, I'm sorry," Jake had said. "I don't think you brought it, did you, Alice?"
The waitress, slightly flushed, had suggested to Jake that, "Your daughter can order something else."
"We'll both have water," Jake said, his jaw tensing.
That night, after Alice was naked, Jake asked her to sit on his lap and said,
"You are perfect."
"Thank you," Alice said, thinking of the daily, lung-burning swims in the cold ocean.
"I have something to ask you," Jake said, his voice a little hoarse. "You don't have to do it if you don't want to. But I'd like to take some pictures of you, just as you are now."
"What do you mean? Naked?"
"Just for me, I promise. No one else will ever see them."
"Why do you want pictures when you can see me whenever you want? Just like this?" She leaned back a little on his lap, nearly slipping off, and opened her arms.
"Here's the thing, Alice, and I understand that you'll never grasp this at your age, but the way you look now, you are not going to look like this forever, and you'll want to preserve it somehow. In pictures. Trust me.
Do you want to take the pictures right now?
No, not right now. I just wanted to make the suggestion. If we do it, I'd want to make everything perfect. The lighting, everything.
I don't mind, but I don't want anyone to see them except for you. Ever.
I promise,
he said.
They will be just for me. And for you. One day, you'll cherish them.
That weekend, they took the pictures. Jake bought a fancy-looking camera for the occasion, plus a light meter, and Alice posed on the bed in the master bedroom. At first, she was nervous and self-conscious, but then it started to get fun and sexy. Jake was surprisingly quiet the whole time. Alice thought he might have specific ideas for how she should pose, but he didn't. He let her do what she wanted. When she thought they were done, however, Jake said,
"Let's take some in your old bedroom."
"Why?" Alice asked.
"It's more you,"
Jake said.
"In here, it looks like you're play-acting. In your room, it will look more natural."
She did what he asked, feeling a little strange posing on her single bed underneath the Duran Duran poster and the small shelf that held her cross-country trophies. But it made Jake happy, and after he put the camera away, they had sex in Alice's old room for the first time. Afterward, Alice asked, "Where will you get the pictures developed?"
"I have a friend at work with a dark room, and he said I could use it."
"You won't show him?"
"No, of course not. Those pictures are just for us."
"I don't want anyone else to see me like this. Ever. Just you."
"One day you will. One day I'll be too old for you. I'm probably too old for you now. And then you'll find someone else, someone younger. I won't mind. It's natural."
Alice didn't say anything right away. It was not that she didn't know that Jake, almost 50, was considered too old for her, although she thought about Richard Gere in Pretty Woman and how hot he was. But she had somehow never imagined him getting older. She imagined herself getting older, but him staying the same. "I don't know about that," she said.
"You will," Jake answered.
They lay on the bed a little longer. "Did you always want this?" she asked.
"Want what?"
"Want me. Want me more than you wanted my mom." Alice heard the faintest clicking sound. It was Jake, tapping his teeth together, something he did when he was thinking.
"Yes,"
he finally said. That whole first winter after her mother died, Alice had successfully avoided any contact with the kids she'd known from Kennewick High. All except Gina, who wrote frequent letters from New York City that Alice would occasionally answer. At the end of her freshman year at NYU, Gina had, predictably, gotten a modeling contract that was going to keep her in the city throughout the summer. But in August, she came home for 2 weeks and showed up unannounced at Alice's house on a Thursday afternoon.
"I knew you wouldn't answer my calls, so I just thought I'd come over."
She held out a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine. Alice suggested they go to the beach, but Gina said it was too hot. They ended up drinking the wine in the living room and eating Triscuits with port wine cheese. Gina was skinnier and prettier than ever. She'd lightened her hair, and it had been styled so that it lifted off her forehead, then cascaded down her back. Her dark, thick eyebrows had been shaped, and her nails were painted a neon orange. "Tell me about modeling," Alice said.
"You want to hear the good parts or the sordid details?"
"What do you think?" Gina told a few stories. The first time she tried cocaine.
"It made me act like my little sister, or like Stephanie Richmond from Cross Country, remember her?"
A slew of parties, endless proposals from older men, one of whom offered her $10,000 to sleep with his wife while he watched.
"They're so gross," she said. "The older they are, the grosser they are."
"Do you have a boyfriend?" Alice asked, hoping to change the subject from older men. Gina hadn't mentioned Jake yet, but she knew she would. She'd alluded several times in her letters over the winter that she thought it was strange Alice was still living with him, that she thought Alice should move to New York City and stay with her for a while. It was only a matter of time till she brought it up. And it was only a matter of time till Jake came home. He was always home by 5, and sometimes earlier, since the bank closed its doors at 4. "Let's go swimming," Alice said, after Gina told her she didn't have a boyfriend in New York.
"I don't have a suit," Gina said.
"Borrow one of mine."
"Okay, I guess."
Alice went to go upstairs, and Gina got up to follow. Alice suddenly realized that it might be obvious to Gina she was sharing a bedroom with Jake. Half her clothes were now in his bedroom, and the bed in her old room hadn't been slept in months.
"I'll bring you down some suits to try," Alice said, bolting up the stairs.
"Sure," Gina said, shrugging.
Alice changed into her favorite bikini upstairs and brought down a few extras for Gina to try. She was shocked when Gina stripped down right in the living room. Gina must have read Alice's face because she said,
"Sorry, model life, I have zero modesty."
"That's okay."
Gina picked a black bikini that had white lace trim. The bottom fit fine, but the top was too big for her flat chest. Alice got her a t-shirt to wear over the suit, and together they walked across the softened asphalt of the parking lot and the scalding sand to where the waves were breaking against the shore.
"It's cold," Gina squealed as they waded in.
"You'll get used to it," Alice said,
jumping as a wave rolled up against her. She dove under the water and came up just as Gina tentatively lowered herself into the froth. They swam out together past the breaking waves, then both lay back, spreading out their arms, riding the swells. Gina's white t-shirt billowed around her.
"Okay, this is nice now," Gina said. "Maine's not so bad."
"Better than New York?"
"God, no. I'll come back and visit here in the summer, but other than that, no thanks."
Alice didn't immediately say anything, and Gina said,
"Sorry, that was a little harsh. I'm just talking about for me, of course."
They rode together up a high swell, then slid down its backside. Alice's mouth tasted salty.
"So you're done trying to get me to move to the city?"
"How will you know you don't like it if you don't try? We'd have so much fun, Al. I mean it. I'd introduce you to my manager, and I bet you could get some modeling work yourself. Probably not runway stuff because of your size, but I bet there'd be something. I mean, look at how gorgeous you are."
Alice laughed. "I'll think about it," she said, just to shut Gina up. What she really wanted to say was, why would I go somewhere where everyone is looking for a better life when I've already found it? I have the fairy tale ending already.
"Is that your stepdad?" Gina suddenly said.
She was shielding her eyes with her hand and looking toward shore. Alice did the same thing. Jake was there, just beyond the waterline, looking out toward the swimmers. He still wore his suit, the light blue linen one. Alice almost denied it, but it was obviously him. Instead, she waved to catch his attention and said,
"Yeah, there's Jake."
"God, you are sleeping with him, aren't you?"
Gina said, as they both bobbed in the water, watching him wave back at them. Chapter 12. Now.
"You think he had any enemies? Disgruntled customers?" Harry asked John.
They were taking a coffee break after a morning spent packaging orders that had come in through the internet. John finished his sip of coffee, holding the chipped mug in both hands. He thought for a moment.
"Enemies, no. Disgruntled customers, not really, either. If someone was upset with the books we sent them, we'd always give a refund. Besides, even if we didn't..."
He made a face that suggested a disgruntled rare book collector was not a likely murder suspect.
"And there was nothing strange about that day?" "Not that I can remember. It was business as usual, and he left a little early, but just because he wanted to get a walk in before it got dark. He did that a lot of days." "Do they think this was a premeditated thing?"
His cataract-clouded eyes showed concern, as they had ever since Harry had told him what he'd learned the previous day.
No, I don't think they have any guesses, except that he was hit on the head. Just hooligans, maybe,
John said, as though the hooligan problem in Kennewick was well documented. Then he said,
What's Alice say? Nothing. She doesn't really want to talk about it.
John tapped his fingers together, thinking. Harry looked at his large, strong hands and concluded, not for the first time, that John looked more like a retired farmhand than a retired financial advisor. He was almost completely bald, and his pate was speckled with sun damage. He was wearing a dark pinstriped suit and a pink tie, knotted tightly at his neck. He always wore suits, always a little too big for him, remnants from his years in business.
I wouldn't worry about it, Harry, he said at last. She's probably in shock and not wanting to process it yet. Plus, she has to be wondering about the rest of her life. My sweetheart died quite young, and afterward I didn't think I'd ever know a moment of happiness again. And then one day I felt a little better, and then over time I became myself again. It always happens that way. Otherwise, no one would keep going. Sorry, Harry. Didn't mean to...
John rubbed at his white mustache, the tremor in his arm more noticeable than usual. Harry wondered if he had Parkinson's, or if he was just old, his muscles weakening.
That's okay, John. Police will find whoever had to do with it. They have ways. Back to work, I think.
Harry watched as John stood up, then lowered himself to one knee by one of many unopened packages, and slit the tape with a box cutter. Lou, the cat, sidled up and rubbed against John's thigh. Harry, tired from that morning's work, wanted to sit a while longer and finish his coffee. How old was John? He had to be in his mid-70s, at least, possibly closer to 80. Harry remembered the story his father had told him, how John had shown up shortly after he'd opened the new store, asking if he could volunteer for a few hours per week, maybe straighten the shelves or deal with customers. He was a retiree, with time on his hands, and Bill had reluctantly agreed to let him come in for a few hours each week. The next day, John had shown up at opening time and stayed until Bill sent him home sometime in the afternoon. It continued like that, John learning every facet of the business, until Bill finally insisted on paying him. They haggled and settled on the minimum wage. After that, John was always at the store, always wearing a suit and tie. He'd made himself indispensable. Harry finished his coffee and went to help stack the new books on one of the two card tables in the store's back room. There were about 30 of these unopened boxes, all containing books from one estate sale that Bill had purchased sight unseen, making an offer over the phone after hearing that the man who had died had collected hardcover Woodhouse novels. Harry's father had started book scouting when he was still an undergraduate at Columbia, studying English literature and hoping to become a writer. One of his professors had gotten him into it, sending him upstate to garage and rummage sales the summer before his senior year. He taught him what to look for and how to negotiate. One of the lessons was to never bicker over single volumes at estate sales. If there was something in the shelves that was worth money, then you would always make a fast offer to buy all the books. The children of the deceased were almost always thrilled and relieved, and you never knew what other gems might appear. Bill had fallen in love with book scouting. Treasure hunting for the unadventurous, he'd called it, and for 10 years after college made a meager living at it, sticking to the East Coast and selling his finds at the then myriad selection of used bookstores in the city. By the time he was 30, he could barely navigate his single-bedroom Greenwich Village apartment because of the stacks of books he'd accumulated. He got a loan at a bank and opened Ackerson's Rare Books. His first employee was a shy Barnard College grad named Emily Vichinsky. They married 3 months after he hired her, and 9 months after that, Harry was born.
Junk, mostly, so far,
John said, slitting open another box and peering at its contents.
How can you tell?
Harry asked.
You learn, over time.
He was holding an interesting-looking hardcover edition of Jaws, with a black cover and the image of a white stylized shark. He put that one to the side.
Although I double-check myself, take a look at prices on the web. Your father didn't need to do that.
The bell sounded, indicating that someone had entered the store.
Do you mind seeing if someone needs help?
John asked, and Harry went out front, stood behind the cash register. The customer was an elderly woman, dressed in a long winter coat and a woolly hat, even though it was nearly 70 degrees outside.
Can I help you with anything?
Harry asked, and she looked up, startled.
Oh, I didn't see you there. I've been here before, of course, but I've forgotten. Can you tell me where the mystery stories are?
Harry stepped out from behind the counter and brought the woman to the mystery section. It was, except for plain fiction, the largest in the store. Crime had been his father's favorite genre, both to read and to collect. He'd had a sizable personal collection of first editions, plus what he claimed might be the only entire collection of mapbacks, mid-century paperbacks issued by Dell, almost all crime novels, each with an illustrated map on its back cover. It had been his pride and joy.
They're not worth a lot of money, he told Harry once, but the day I got the final one in the series was one of my top days. Silly, I know.
Oh, so many, said the woman, looking at the mystery shelves.
There are more in the back, Harry said, if you're interested in collectibles and first editions.
I don't think so. What I like is a murder story, but I don't like violence.
Harry was about to go get John for a recommendation, but decided he could handle this himself. He was not a fanatic like his father had been, but Harry did read a lot. He found three books for the woman, two by Jacqueline Winspear based on their covers alone, and an M.C. Beaton that she thought she hadn't read yet. He brought the books back to the register and rang up the sale himself, relieved that she was paying in cash so he wouldn't have to use the credit card reader. Afterward, he told John he'd just managed his first customer interaction. John put one of his large hands on Harry's shoulder.
Thank you, Harry. Honestly, I don't know what I'd do right now without you.
The words made Harry feel wanted, but were also discomforting. How long would he be expected to help out? Was there a future plan for the store now that Bill had died? He assumed Alice now owned it, including all its stock. She'd occasionally worked in the store, although Harry didn't know how much she actually knew or cared about the business. It was clear that John had learned an enormous amount from Bill, but he was just an employee, and how much longer could he expect to work at his age? Was Harry being groomed to take over forever? The thought knotted his stomach briefly.
This is my life now.
Then Harry told himself to calm down. His father had died less than a week ago, and there was plenty of time to figure everything out. He found his own cutter and began opening boxes. Toward the end of the day, the bell sounded, the front door opening to a customer for just the fourth time that day. As John had explained, the store did 90% of its business online and very little from the actual physical store. Harry went to his post at the cash register. The customer was the woman from the funeral, with the short, dark hair. She was wearing the headband again. Harry felt his cheeks flush at the sight of her. She spotted him and walked right over, almost too purposefully.
Hello, she said.
Hi.
I was wondering if you're hiring. I know there isn't a sign out front, but I thought I'd check anyway. I just moved here and I love books, so I thought...
Her cheeks were flushed as well. She was nervous, and the words she'd just said sounded rushed and unnatural.
Didn't I see you on Sunday at...
Oh, that, she said. Yeah, I was at the funeral. I saw you too. You must be...
I'm his son.
Right, his son. I'm very sorry for your loss.